The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the Upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
My name is Kyle Estep, and I'm one of the pastors and elders on the team. And always a privilege to be worshiping with you this morning and each and every opportunity we get. If you are a guest with us, I'll add my welcome and gratitude to you for joining us today. We are grateful that you've chosen to be here with us, and we try to acknowledge this as often as we can. There are wonderful churches all over the upstate, and so it's really never lost on us when you choose to spend a morning with us. And we hope and pray that you feel welcomed and encouraged as we celebrate God's goodness and faithfulness together. That's what we want to do week in and week out when we get the opportunity. We are going to continue our walk through the Psalms, and you have already heard Psalm 37 read over you, which is a beautiful, beautiful psalm and a timely word, I think we will discover here together. So if you have your Bibles, you can return to Psalm 37 again with me, and as you turn there, I want to acknowledge why I think it could be a timely psalm, why I think it is a beautiful and powerful psalm, is because I think if you've lived any amount of time on this earth, you have probably come to a place where you have started to recognize that there are few questions that have a tendency to trouble God's people more than this one. More than the one that David later in his life is going to address, and it's this question: why do the wicked seem to prosper while those who seek to follow God seem to often struggle? Why is it, God, that it feels like in our experience that oftentimes the wicked, they're having their way, and we're wrestling constantly? We've all asked it in one way or another. The news cycle will not let you escape it. Life brings it to mind. The dishonest get promoted, and seemingly those who ignore God are the ones who tend to flourish. And if we're honest, there are moments when obedience can feel, in the experience, in the way that we're navigating through life, it can feel like it's not paying off. It's not actually bringing the dividend that I thought it would bring compared to what I'm seeing around me. And there are multiple psalms that address this, but David is particularly addressing it in a wonderful season of life where he has, in my view, as we read through this psalm, the right to address it. I don't know who it is for you. One of the heroes of my life in faith is my grandfather on my dad's side, Lonzo Estep. That's right, that was his name. Not Alonzo, just Lonzo. And I've shared this before. He had brothers Herschel and Claude and Bob. And it's like all Cracker Barrel breakfast, you know? that was the family line of names, I think. But... And there's a sense in which he's a hero of mine because he didn't just age, he aged with wisdom. He aged with grace. He aged with greater patience. He aged in a way that seemed unhurried, but also unrattled. And it was distinct to observe even when I was young. David is writing into Psalm 37 in a world that doesn't feel, I think, as far removed as we might want to make it from our own. A world where you have to take a view of everything that acknowledges, Lord, I want to trust you, but sometimes I don't get it. I want to believe what I know to be true, but sometimes it doesn't add up with the experience of life. David wrote into that world. It's different from many of the other Psalms because it's not a cry from the middle of crisis. It's not a prayer for deliverance. It really is wisdom literature. In fact, it is this acrostic poem that moves through the entire Hebrew alphabet. Like David is kind of saying to you and to me, I've lived long enough to give you the A to the Z of trusting God. I want you to know that I'm not talking to you as someone new to the experiences that you are facing. I want you to know I'm looking back over the categories of my entire life, A to Z as it were. And I have something to say, and this is what I have to say to you. I've seen a lot. I've seen so much. I know the highs and the lows of this life. I know the ones I've caused myself, and I know the ones I've endured that have been done to me. And in all of it, I can testify to the unyielding, unrelenting faithfulness of God. I think if you're thinking about Psalm 37, think of it this way. This is a settled testimony of someone who has watched the righteous suffer, endured great suffering himself, sometimes from his own choices, oftentimes from the choices of others, watched the wicked prosper time and time again, and still comes to this conclusion. God is always faithful. God is always good. God will always do right, even when his timing makes no sense to me. I think the psalm could be summarized in a sentence that could hang with us in our hearts and minds for the rest of the morning. And if I were to put that thought in front of us to kind of sit with us as we walk through the psalm, it would be this: in a world chasing what fades, the steady soul befriends faithfulness. In a world that often chases what fades, the steady soul befriends faithfulness. And this psalm is a long psalm. We read it over you on purpose because to navigate through it verse by verse would leave you here for a while. And it feels lovely in this room, but I don't think that's where we're going. I want us to take a little bit of a high view through the psalm and the time we have together to land where I think the psalm is really trying to drive our worship and our understanding and our growth in the beauty of who God is. And it simply is to set our minds and our hearts in this place where we can be honest about what we see in the world with the Lord, but we can pull, as it were, our mind and our heart together to understand something of the wisdom, the skillful way that David has learned to live his life, that he is passing along to us, that actually might shape and form the way we keep moving forward in the days we have remaining. In a world chasing what fades, the steady soul befriends faithfulness. That phrase comes right from verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good, dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. It's a really unusual phrase. Some translations render it feed on faithfulness, cultivate faithfulness. The idea is that you and I would make faithfulness a kind of daily companion, a near friend. We would practice faithfulness. We would learn of faithfulness. We would kind of feed on faithfulness and be energized and fueled by the joy of seeing it played out through the pages of Scripture, rather than being obsessed over the temporary seeming successes of others, particularly those who practice wickedness or evil or someone else's gain. It would be this trust that the Lord is going to shape each and every day of my life by redefining what it means to be successful, what it means to be good, what it means to have the life that's really life. And it would be redefined by faithfulness. And David, who is wise and gives this well-learned invitation to us, offers us the way to do that through this psalm. And in the first 11 verses, you're going to come back to the beginning, but in the first 11 verses, you get one of the steps of learning to live and befriend faithfulness in a world that seems like the wicked are prospering and the righteous are suffering, and we're asking God, what are you doing? And the first principle David gives is to resist the temptation to envy. Notice how David begins the psalm. There aren't explanations. He's not going to start by telling you, now let me explain why this is happening. That's not what he does. He starts with commands. Fret not, do not envy, trust, do good, dwell, befriend faithfulness, delight yourself in the Lord, commit your way to the Lord, trust the Lord, be still with the Lord, wait patiently upon the Lord. Those are all commands in worship in Psalm 37. Before David ever addresses what the wicked are doing, he addresses what's going on in your heart and mine and in his own. A step we often skip. Like, there is a natural tendency to look at the world around us and circumstances around us and all the chaos around us and all the moving pieces around us and look back at God and try to make some interpretation of who God is based on everything we see in front of us. And the scriptures constantly pull us back into the practice that David prescribes, which is, you know who God is, see who God declares himself to be, and allow the reality of who God is to define the way you actually see what is in front of you and what is happening and what is constantly moving in the life and the world in which you are part of. And we flip that so easily, and David calls us back to that. And he starts with this word, do not fret. It's a word that quite literally means this idea of becoming heated or burning inside. Have you ever noticed how anxiety and envy do that to a person? Like, it starts with comparison, but before long, your heart is burning. You replay conversations. You resent someone else's success. You become consumed by someone else's life. You cannot even situate your own heart at home with the Lord to be content because it is full of ideas that just keep churning inside of you, building a kind of heat that exposes your own passion to have somebody else's life. And David says, by the grace of God, we resist that at all cost. And part of that is the faithful step of obedience to the things that are commanded to the heart and the mind and the soul. Why? Because appearances and apparent successes of the wicked are deceptive. He's trying to remind the reader of that so that they can be invited into the posture of slowing down enough to resist the temptation to only see what's in front of them and interpret something about God that is not built on the truth. And he says in verse 2, for they, the wrongdoer, the evildoer, will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. And David's imagery for the prosperity of the wicked is that it will look permanent to you at first glance, but from God's perspective, it is extremely temporary. And that's a really important reminder because we tend to judge by what we can see right now. And David is saying, instead of focusing on those who seem to be succeeding without him, I want to pull your heart toward these positive commands to be in a place where you can think rightly about what's going on, and then you can start to understand, and then you can have the kind of skill and wisdom for living in that world you find yourself in. But first, I have to kind of awaken you to get out of that natural way of thinking. So there's these two kind of presses, don't fret, don't envy, and then there's these positive commands that David gives us. First, he says, trust in the Lord. These four positive commands all bound up. Trust in the Lord. Trust means placing our confidence not in the circumstances, but in God's character. It's not pretending. It's honest about life. Life is hard, not easy at all times. It's a trust that believes God is present and moving alongside of you even when life is extremely difficult. Perhaps that nearness is even more available to you if you open your eyes and trust him. He goes, trust in the Lord, and then he says, do good. And I love that that trust does not lead toward, you know what, trust the Lord and just feel good about it. Have a positive attitude. Positivity changes all of life. Well, yeah, there's a level in which positive thinking helps, but notice trust doesn't lead to just thinking positively. It also is not some passive action on your part. He doesn't say, trust God, tell yourself it's going to be okay, and then sit down. No, he says, trust God and keep doing what is right. Take the next right step in front of you. Trust the Lord for the next right step in the moment. Do the good right thing that is just right here, right now, in front of you. Third, he says, delight yourself in the Lord. Verse 4 tends to be one of the most quoted, most sometimes, not most, but oftentimes misunderstood. He says, delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. It's not a blank check. We would like for it to be. But it's actually a really beautiful invitation where when you learn to enjoy the presence of God, the company of his word, the promises of his faithfulness, when you start to see him for who he has revealed himself to be, when you remind yourself of the pathway of marker after marker, monument after monument of grace and faithfulness that he has established, he reshapes your perspective, redefines your understanding of this life, renews and grants even new desires that increasingly align with him, where what you begin to experience is the reality of, I want what you want, and I'm learning to ask for it, and you delight to give it. And then fourthly, I've anchored here because I could not get off of this phrase for the last few weeks. David says something really, really beautifully kind of unexpected. Trust the Lord. Do good. Dwell in the land. Like, be content where God has placed you in his wisdom and his sovereignty. You're not here by accident. Acts chapter 17, God determined the boundary lines of your dwelling and the periods of time you would dwell there. Dwell there. Delight in the Lord. Learn him. Enjoy him. Watch him reshape you from the inside out. And then he says, befriend faithfulness. There's other ways to say it. I just think that is a wonderful, wonderful phrase. Because in the midst of this raging kind of question that keeps popping up as you walk through life, and the often seemingly imbalance of the wicked and the righteous and the things God's up to or allowing, there is a real natural instinct to go chased after something you can grab a hold of. Like to grasp for something that feels secure and it feels safe and it feels comforting and it feels defining and it feels successful and it feels prosperous. It feels good to grab a hold of. And the culture in which you and I live says befriend success and recognition and power and comfort and security and safety and do it at all cost. And David comes along and says, there's a far better way I've learned as I look back over life and I look at the world and I wonder when the wicked prospers and the evil doer seems to just advance with no restriction. There's a far better way. Befriend faithfulness. Make faithfulness your best companion. Make abiding with the Lord, delighting in the Lord, joy-filled obedience to the Lord, your closest companions. Learn to measure your life, not by outcomes. Not that they're wrong, but you don't measure your life by them, but by faithfulness to the Lord, to what is good and to what is right. And so we first learn to navigate through the question that wrestles in the heart as we look at life in this world. We learn to live faithfully with the Lord, trusting His faithfulness to us, first by resisting the temptation of envy. And we do so as we trust the Lord, do good, dwell in the land, delight in Him, and befriend faithfulness. He goes on and says there's kind of a second principle. We'll come back to that because it's so powerful in terms of how you live day to day. But he says the other thing you have to recognize, and that kind of comes in verses 12 through 26. He says you're going to have to learn to rest. That's a tricky one for us to on a thousand categories. You're going to have to rest in God's timing. David knows the obvious objection. That's what I love about people who are wise, old or young, but if they're wise, they've kind of had this beautiful forethought of the way in which you will naturally object. And David knows that. David knows that the obvious objection would be, but they're still winning. I'll wait on God's timing, but the wicked and the evil are still flourishing. They're still prospering. They're still getting away with it. You want me to wait. I'm standing back here going, yeah, but it sure isn't working. And David's answer to the ideas that they're still winning, they're still prospering, they're still getting away with it, it's a very simple answer. It's a very wise answer. He says, not for long and not forever. I don't like the answer. Because what I'd like for David to say is, not tomorrow. Tomorrow it's over. No more of that. Throughout this entire section in the middle of the psalm, he just keeps reminding us that God's timeline is broader, fuller, usually much longer than ours. We're a people of urgency. And verse 13 says something really strong that we need to hear if we're going to learn to rest in God's timing. Verse 12 and 13, it says this, the wicked plot against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. And then verse 13 says, but the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. Not because suffering is funny, not because evil doesn't matter, but because it never catches God off guard. There's not a time he is surprised by what surprises us. There's not a time that he is unaware by what troubles us when we look at the wicked prospering or the evildoer advancing. It's just that he knows their end. He is confident of the conclusion of all evil and the enemy who fans it along. Their end is certain, and he does not question it. Again and again, David's going to contrast what looks impressive right now with what will matter forever. Down in verse 16, he says, better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. I don't know about you, but that cuts directly against everything that the world you and I live in and the natural order of that world tends to teach us. There is a very persistent belief that more is always better. And God, in His kindness, talks about righteousness as better. And David comes along and says, a little with God is better than the abundance you might experience momentarily without Him. And that is difficult to believe at times, perhaps until you've lived long enough to see it is absolutely true. I find it difficult to believe at times. It sure feels like at times, it's really easy to go, a little more would be a little better. Fill in whatever you want for more, not just money. I mean, right now, a little more money feels like it would be a little better. But that's easy. That's instinctive. Maybe David has, in fact, earned the wisdom that looks back at you and I and says, I have lived long enough to see that possessions and power and personal accomplishments don't actually deliver peace the way that faithfulness does. I'm trying to hold for us what I think is really powerful in the psalm, but you have to kind of jump back again to verse 7, which is one of the hardest commands in the whole psalm. He says, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. And so I thought, you know, waiting on the Lord is not something we tend to enjoy doing immediately. It's a learned behavior in God's grace and his mercy and his kindness. There's a really famous theologian named Tom Petty. Just kidding. And he said, the waiting is the hardest part. And he was onto something. Just not in the way I think David was onto it. But he's not wrong. Nobody, think about that. Nobody from the time you exit the womb crying in this world likes to wait. Nobody. In America, multiply it. You like waiting on nothing. The microwave is too slow for you. 16 minutes in the air fryer might as well be an eternity. Forget 8 hours on the smoker. I mean, don't forget it. It's pretty great. Time. But it's interesting because for David's purposes and the way in which the Bible defines waiting, it's never as passive as we like to make it. Ours is like, you know, the person sitting in the chair and the foot is just, I mean, you just can't, please tell me it's time, you know. It's the child who says, is it time yet? And they wait an entire 11 seconds before they ask you again. Now? In the scriptures, it's this wonderful image of trust stretched over the corridor of time. It's like taking the period of your waiting, if you could see its beginning and its end, and stretching trust around it to hold it together. It's waiting, trusting, actively listening, pursuing the Lord. And it's this idea that you are refusing to try to seize control because you do believe God has not lost it. And it fights in you because one of the natural things you'll do in the waiting is, I think I could do that. I think I can take care of that. I think I can organize that. I could control this. Lord, what if I did this for you? One of the most challenging things as a young parent is children who won't sleep in the car. But one of the most beautiful blessings is when they do crash in the car. And if you ever think about a child who's asleep in the back seat of a moving car, now very much strapped in. Many of you grew up not strapped in. How you slept in peace is a whole nother level of faith. So let's use you. Let's use those of you who slept in a car, and if that car stopped, it was bye-bye. But the interesting thing is the child rarely, if ever, knows the route. They have no idea where you're going. They couldn't read the map to you if you gave them a year to try to figure it out. And they have this ability to rest because they believe you know where you're going. And David says, what I'm trying to call you to in this psalm is active obedience, active resistance to the things that pull you into the confusion of the question, why do the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer? By resisting envy and then by resting and trusting that God actually knows and is choosing himself to be responsible to get you to the promised destination and finish the work he started in you along the way. Sounds lovely. Constant, daily choice and faith-based belief that it's true. That's what life feels like. And then he gives us this third and final principle. I want you to resist the temptation to envy through trusting the Lord, doing good, dwelling where God has you, delighting in him, and befriending faithfulness. I want you to rest in God's timing by paying attention not to what seems like prosperity and success and advancement, but to what delivers actual joy and peace and contentment and life. And then I want you to know that you can do those things because you remember how the story ends. In the final verses, verses 27 through 40, David closes the psalm, lifts our eyes toward the future, and listen for these repeated words throughout the psalm: inheritance, future, peace, salvation, refuge, help, deliverance. And then the two principles that are wrapped up in there throughout the psalm: the wicked have a future and it's short, and the righteous have a future and it's eternal. And verse 37 says this: mark the blameless and behold the upright, for there is a future for the man of peace. David is not saying that the righteous avoids suffering. He's saying suffering never gets the final word. Therefore, these final few verses of David's Psalm of Wisdom shift our attention away from what God's people do to what God himself is doing while you're living in a world where the news cycle is constantly appealing that you would see the world through the wicked and evildoers' prosperity, or that your own circumstances are constantly pulling you back into this temptation to believe that God doesn't see you, he doesn't understand you, he doesn't know you, he doesn't care about your life, he's just distant and removed and sitting aloof in the clouds. And David shifts our attention and says, take your eyes off of them. Take your eyes off of yourself for a moment. And remember who God is and what the Lord has promised to do. Listen to these words. The salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their stronghold in the time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. That means the Lord helps us, the Lord delivers us, the Lord saves us, and the Lord lives as a refuge constantly to us. That's the emphasis that David is making. The Lord is the active subject. Our hope has never rested on how well we figure out faithfulness in a world constantly pressing and wrestling against that notion. It's that he has promised to take hold of those who have taken hold of him by faith, and he will bring you through this world of wickedness and this wrestle of faithfulness and this constant temptation for envy and the lack and absence of contentment, and he will bring you to the finish line. Why? Because he promised. It's quite literally because he promised to do so. Because his faithfulness is greater than ours. Psalm 37 is a beautiful word of wisdom right now in your life. How can you believe it's true wisdom And that's what I love about where I think the psalm lives as a signpost aiming forward. It takes our hearts to Jesus Christ, who is the only person who perfectly befriended faithfulness. This time when you say, who actually was faithful in the midst of this world without error and without blemish? And the Sunday school answer actually works. Jesus. He really was. He never envied. He never sinned. He never repaid evil for evil. He entrusted himself completely to his Father. And for a brief moment, it looked as though wickedness had won. At the cross, it looked and appeared as though evil was victorious and the righteous one was condemned and the wicked were celebrating and darkness covered the earth. But the costly and loving sacrifice of Jesus Christ, followed by the glorious resurrection morning, proved David's wise words of Psalm 37 are telling you the truth. Evil and wickedness will never have the final word. And what's so remarkable about Jesus is he was the truly righteous man who inherits the earth. He is the true friend of faithfulness who by grace shares his inheritance with all who belong to him. And because he remains perfectly faithful even to this very day, we are forgiven our failures and empowered to pursue and befriend faithfulness each and every new day. So what do you and I do today and tomorrow and in our ordinary days? In these ordinary days of waiting, in these ordinary days in the time between Christ first coming and his appearing again, in the ordinary days of your life where God in his wisdom and his sovereignty has placed you to live for his glory and his fame, what do you do right now when it seems, when you look around and I look around, like there's no slowing down wickedness and evil. Like there's no slowing down the prosperity of people who go about it all the wrong ways. And that maybe, just maybe, not only is there no slowing it down, more and more suffering may have to be endured. What do you do when that's what you're staring down the barrel at in the life that's supposed to be really life? I believe David gives you that in the early commands. I think verses 3-5 are to strengthen us for such a time as this. Trust in the Lord and do good. Do what is right and right in front of you. Dwell in the land where God in his grace and wisdom and mercy has placed you for the time he's put you there. And make one of your best friends faithfulness. Delight and find great joy in the Lord, who is unmistakably good. Find yourself finding his desires more and more appealing so that you learn to ask for the things that he loves to give. Commit your ways in work and life and marriage and parenting and singleness and aspirations and dreams to the Lord. Trust in him and rest in him and wait on him and know and believe again and again and teach your mind and your heart to agree he will act. Nearly everybody around you will spend their life trying to make friends with success and comfort and maybe power. And David says, by the grace of God and the mercy of God, make friends with faithfulness. I'm going to ask Brian and Meredith to come back up. And I just want to leave you thinking about your future according to David. One day, every apparent injustice will be answered. Every hidden act of obedience will be seen. Every promise of God will stand. Every tear will be wiped away. Every heartache will be made new. Every ounce of darkness will be gone because of the sufficiency of his light. And David, in his wisdom and his later years, just says, until then, don't chase what fades. Become a friend of faithfulness. There's a hymn we have sung, most of us in this room, for a pretty good portion of our lives that echoes David's words, and it just says this: great is thy faithfulness, great is thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed, thy hand hath provided. Great is thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me. In a world chasing what fades, the steady soul befriends faithfulness. By the grace and mercy of God, let's stand. Let's remember his promises, remember his goodness and his faithfulness. Sing with joy and delight that what is true about him is what we are building our lives upon.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.